Hi, I'm Joe Feeks, editor of Pig Health Today, and with me is Dr. Chris Rademacher. He is Extension Swine Specialist and a veterinarian at Iowa State University. Great to see you, Chris.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sow mortality has really grabbed the pork industry's attention, and you and your team at Iowa State have been looking at these sow pelvic prolapses. Mm-hmm. Why did you single those out? Is that the primary cause?
It's not the primary cause, but I think what we've been hearing from industry personnel, veterinarians, producers, and so on is there's always been some, but there's been a gradual increase probably over the last 10 to 15 years. And then really started in about 2013, we really started to hear about it. And actually the incidence doubled in that kind of over that last 5 years, kind of starting in 2013, 14. And nobody really knows why. They haven't really been able to pin it down to one specific thing. We had a lot of veterinarians kind of working on it on their own, you know, trying to do some record analysis involving a few other people. So, but it had gotten to a problem because we've seen this doubling over the last 5 years that we had producers and veterinarians go to the National Pork Board and say, hey, we need some expertise. We need people dedicated full-time to study this. So the team from the Iowa Pork Industry Center, which is a collaboration between Iowa State, the College of Vet Med, the College of Agriculture, and the College of Ag Engineering, got the swine faculty together, and we were able to put in a proposal and was funded by the National Pork Board really to kind of do a deep, in-depth study to look at all the different potential factors that could be causing this increase in pelvic organ prolapses.
And I guess the good thing, if you could call it that, is that this is pretty easy to spot.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, the farm staff can point it out. If we look at this database summaries, you know, many times the most prominent cause of death for sow farms is unknown because, you know, like she was fine today and the workers came in the next morning and the sow was dead. But this one they can very obviously see. And it's becoming, you know, more of an issue. So people are starting to talk about it more. And there's a lot of theories going around potential reasons why. So we hear a lot of that too. So the nice thing about the survey, what allowed us to do is really kind of dig in and maybe not only find, you know, the goal was try to find 3 to 5 researchable hypotheses that we could really do more in-depth study. This was really just kind of a survey to try to rule things in, but maybe as equally important, and rule things out that maybe, you know, anecdotally, a lot of people say, well, that makes sense. That's got to be the cause. So we wanted to say, what are the 3 to 5 that really the pork industry should really be working on? And let's get rid of the ones that people talk about, but really the data didn't support that those being a significant cause.
And I want to get into those in just a minute, but just to get all of our viewers on the same page so that we know what we're talking about mm-hmm. here. When we talk about a pelvic organ prolapse, again, might be easy to spot, but how do you define it? Is there any confusion about it?
Absolutely, certainly. And we've had people try to track it over the years. And really, they call it pelvic organ prolapses because it can be a vaginal prolapse, it can be a full uterine prolapse, or it can be a rectal prolapse, or it can be some combination of the above. And some people will say, well, rectal prolapses are caused by this, but uterine prolapses are caused by that. So in an effort to really just boil it down and get to a summary, one consistent outcome, we just put all those together and put it underneath the term pelvic organ prolapse, or POP for short.
Okay. So what exactly are you doing to try to better understand this problem?
The nice thing about it is really an industry collaboration. We went out and we were looking for farms, not only that had high prolapse problems, we always hear from those people first, right? Because it's an issue, right? But we wanted to get some people that were maybe just having normal or baseline, but then we wanted to get some people enrolled that had really low prolapse mortality. So we recruited and we finished up with about 104 sow farms across the U.S. representing about 400,000 sows, which is roughly about 8% of the swine industry, right? So a pretty nice subset. And what we did is we turned over a form to them because of the inconsistencies in how people record that data. We developed one standardized form that we sent to them, and then every time a sow died on the farm, irregardless of the cause, they started to record some of this information. And then they were turning those into us on a weekly basis. The initial plan was to do it for 6 months, and we had 104 farms that did that, but we probably had 80 of those farms continue to collect data for almost a year. Now, the stuff that we'll talk about today will be the 6 month study. But I mean, we had a combination. We had, like I said, farms that were good, bad, you know, in the middle. But then we went out and we've got, of those 104 farms, we had like 85 of them were from 13 large systems. But then we were also able to get 19 independent, you know, mom and pop, farrow to finish type operations to include too, just because we wanted to make sure we were covering all segments of the industry with the survey.
And what kind of patterns are you seeing?
Oh, well, all sorts of stuff. You know, some of the summary stuff, it was very similar to what other people reported. In other words, they'll see it somewhat seasonally. They tend to see a little more of that maybe in the going into and coming out of the winter months than the other time of the year, so we certainly saw that. And when we kind of look at that, some of the things that we saw was we tried to group the groups into the 20% of the farms that had the biggest problem, the 60% kind of your bell-shaped curve of the middle, then your 20% of the best. And when we looked at those on a week-to-week basis, over that time period, what we saw was the middle and the low ones, their incidence rates was pretty much consistent throughout the year. So most of the variation could be explained by the 20% of the farms that were really having trouble with it. They tended to see that same seasonal pattern, whereas the other ones, they stayed pretty flat throughout the year.
And is that pretty much what you expected to see, or did that come as a surprise?
Somewhat to be expected, at least the seasonality part of it, but that so much of that variation was really just by the 20% farms that were really struggling with it. That was somewhat a surprise.
What's causing these?
Yeah, great question. I would tell you today, I don't think there's any one simple cause, and we kind of knew that going in. It's probably a combination of factors in many cases. So for those farms, they were collecting all that data. And the other thing that we did two other things. We sent out a survey for them to fill out questions, and we questioned everything like, what's your farrowing house protocols? What type of feed do you use? What's your housing look like? Do you use antibiotic pulses? What's your water look like? We looked at just a really all-inclusive survey. A lot of them were ones that people said, hey, we need to look at this. And some of them we just collected because we were already asking all these other questions. And then on about 60% of the farms, we actually sent somebody in to actually do some measurement on a subset of individual sows right before they went into farrowing, because most of the time the occurrences are usually plus or minus 2 weeks on either side of farrowing. That probably captures about 80 to 90% of the pelvic organ prolapses happen during that time period. So we collected all those individual things, and then we just put it into a computerized model to try to look at and see if we could figure out what any of those were. I would tell you we probably found about 3 to 5 things that we'll be doing more research on. You know, one of them, some of them that were expected, some that were not expected at all. You know, many times we hear people talk about, well, it's because we sleeve or because we induce or we see more of it in the big farms. And on those, it was flat. We didn't see any correlation at all, which is good, right? Because we can say, all right, we can get rid of those. Litter size is another one. We looked at that. Litter size didn't appear to have any impact either, right? Yeah, and everybody thinks, well, sows got bigger, so they stretch those muscles more and more likely to have prolapses. But the data that we looked at in those 104 farms really didn't support that as well. Some of the things that we did see, and some were a little bit unexpected. One of the ones that was probably the most significant was water, which was really kind of surprising. And what we found was we compared different water types and then whether they were using some sort of water sanitation system or not. And what we found was anybody who was using a form of water sanitation, whether that was rural water, which comes already somewhat treated, or people were using on-farm treatment units, they had much, much lower pelvic organ prolapse rates than the farms that didn't.
No kidding.
Yeah, and that was when we weren't going in. It's like, well, we're just collecting all this data. Let's take let's add that more to it. You know, we looked at things such as body condition on the farms that we did the measurements on. And once again, the hypothesis was, well, we got big fat sows, and it's the big fat sows that are creating the prolapses. Actually, it was completely the inverse. It was actually the thin sows that were more likely to prolapse than the fat sows. And we did some additional thing about feeding sows late in gestation. What we saw was farms that fed those thin sows late in gestation, fed them more feed, actually tended to have lower prolapse rates. So there may be kind of a nutritional body condition component to it. That was something that we didn't really expect to find.
Is there a genetic connection?
We did look at genetics, because that's one that a lot of people talk about all the time. Now, we did, when we recruited, we didn't necessarily balance for all the different genetics, so we just took whatever farms of those 104 that we could get. So we did see some genetic differences, but some of them, we only had one herd of this genetics or one herd of that genetics. So even though the statistical model attempts to balance for that, it would be hard for us to walk out of here and say, wow, it's definitely a genetic thing. We tended to see a trend towards being genetic differences, but I think to really study that factor, we would probably have to do more prospective type studies, looking at different genetic lines, looking maybe for genetic markers to really be able to tell if what sort of impact that genetics would really have.
What about the parity of the sow?
Yeah, parity was another one we looked at, and that was a little bit more difficult because we kind of tended to use the production records to get that. And that probably shrunk our size of animals that we could look at, but that was the easiest way to do that kind of comparison. What we saw was maybe a slight trend towards animals getting older, maybe having a more likely situation, but it wasn't a strong epidemiological evidence. It was maybe trending towards, you know, sows as they get a little bit older or maybe more at risk, but it wasn't like we weren't seeing anything in the younger parodies and all in the older parodies. We were certainly seeing some all across all parodies, but maybe a little bit of a trend of significance as those sows got a little bit older.
Have you seen any other common denominators in terms of maybe other diseases or maybe even the environment that the pigs are in?
Yeah, great questions. We did look at a couple of facility things. We looked at housing types, right? Because now we've got some dichotomy in our industry where we've got some using group housing and some still putting them in traditional stalls. And we did tend to see a higher probability for those that were in pens than were in stalls. A little bit of that was they weren't super balanced. We had a lot more of some farms that were in the pen housing category. So, but yeah, it looked like there may be something there. And then we looked at not only pelvic organ prolapse, but we looked at overall mortality since we're collecting all overall mortality. And we kind of saw the same trend. Other people talked about that as being a concern with moving to group housing is that mortality may have gone up, may go up a little bit, and we certainly saw that in our data.
And that's the last thing you need right now.
Yeah, absolutely, right? It's high enough the way that it is.
So what are the next steps?
We're doing some more prospective studies looking at the water quality. We're doing some stuff with vaginal microbiome, you know, looking at the different type of compounds or bacteria that might be there to try to figure out this impact is, you know, are we cleaning them up? Another thing that we saw was farms that were doing pulses with antibiotics, while they were on the antibiotic pulse, we would see a temporary decrease in those farms.
Really?
with pelvic organ prolapse, and we'd take them off, it would kind of go back to baseline. So trying to understand a little bit better if there isn't a sanitation or a hygiene or population of bacteria that don't influence that as well on some farms.
And did you see any connection between the disease profile of a herd and
yeah,
the
great question. That was a question because we say, hey, we saw this thing really increase in 2013, 2014. Well, what happened during that time, right?
PED,
we had PED, right?
Yeah.
On about 50% of the sow farm. So we did look at that. We looked a little bit with PED, with PERS. Maybe there's a trend to something there, but it wasn't definitive, not one of the ones that we're probably going to spend any more time looking at.
You've got your hands full. But it's great to see the pork industry being so proactive.
It was. And the great part about it was a collaboration, right? If we didn't have those 13 systems and those 19 independents, because we asked them to do a lot of extra work, right? Every time that a sow died, they'd have to fill all this information out and send it, you know, once a week without getting anything in return. The farms, like I said, that had the high pelvic organ prolapse rate, they were interested, but the farms that weren't, you know, having a problem with it, it was still a lot of time. So it was really a great industry collaboration and really kind of the value of the whole pork checkoff model to be able to do this kind of research.